You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to the Dressage Today podcast. This month, our podcast is sponsored by Purina. Aviva and I are really excited to be interviewing Suzanne DiStefano. This month, Suzanne is a Guild-certified Feldenkrais practitioner, as well as a dressage trainer and instructor. She is based out of Pennsylvania, and we were just really excited to get a little bit more information about what Feldenkrais is and what it can do for riders. So,
what's going on in Aviva's world right now? How are your ponies?
My ponies are okay. Right now in Aviva's world, we had 6 inches of snow, and it's disgusting and gross, and we're getting ready to start that, oh, most wonderful time of year, snow melting down the roof of the indoor. Yeah.
Who spooks more, the person or the horse?
I think at this point, it's the horse, because I've gotten used to it, but not always.
There have been times when I've been teaching in Montana in their indoor, and they've got one of those clear spans. So it's kind of the round,
yes,
you know, yeah, roof. And we're just going along and something happens and I'm like, ah, and the horse and the rider are just going along like, what? They didn't even notice. And I'm like, okay, sorry, I'm spooking for you.
Well, it's nice because our horses do spook. They spook a lot. Mm. Although,
would you say it's because it's not a real regular thing?
I think because it's not a real regular thing in my arena, I have lots of windows that I never close. So they can see it. And then there is the sound, which sounds a little bit like distant mortar fire. You know, it's this thud. So, you know, it's scary. It is scary. It's legit. The spook is legit. Let's just put it that way. It doesn't make it any easier to ride, but it's legit. What's new in your life?
Oh my gosh. I'm running with scissors into the wind. I just got back. I didn't get to go see Kathy for a couple weeks because I was not feeling well. And then she was not feeling well. So I got down there yesterday. No, I got down there Tuesday and we started. She longlined Dante for the first time and he was amazing. He was such a good boy. I didn't have enough time to pay attention to it because I was too busy being the person at the head, but it sounded like she was really happy with him and I'm always really happy with him. So the pirouettes are coming along and we're still working. Right to left change is having some glitches, but we're figuring that out. And today he's going to get a nice hack around the cow pasture. We're going to go check out the cows.
Are the cows actually in the pasture when you're out there?
We go out in the cow pasture. Yeah. And the cows just got worked this week by the cowboys. So the cows will be looking at us a little askance, like, are you moving us? Are you just coming to visit us? What's the deal here, lady? I think because there's only one of us, it makes it a little easier for them. They're like, no, it's just her. It's just the lady that rides through.
Okay.
I'm getting ready for Mary Wanless. She's going to be here in less than 2 weeks. So, you know, there's always that super cleaning, everything that looks fine on a daily basis. You're looking at it suddenly like, oh my gosh, this is not appropriate. And I have to fix everything on my farm all at once. So we've been in that kind of mode. And then you add a nail and a trailer tire on the way home with my horse loaded up yesterday. And
oh my God,
Bob's your uncle.
Did you have a spare? Obviously you were okay. You made it home. What happened?
I did have a spare. I noticed it as soon as I loaded him and I just thought, fooey with this, I'm going to go ahead. And I limped to a tire place. They did not have the equipment to deal with my tires because they're 14 plies. Always put 14 plies on your trailer. Always a good idea.
Okay.
So they switched out for my spare. I drove home on the spare. So he got to, while he was in the trailer, he got to encounter the wonderful, what do they call that? The air gun noise
oh
behind
my
him
God.
Going,
zh, 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 zh.
But it was either that or unload him in a parking lot. So I was like, no, you can stay up there. Yeah. So tire got fixed. We made it home on the spare. We're all good.
Okay.
Just always something exciting.
How far is she for you?
It's 2 hours.
Okay. Not too bad then.
It's 2 hours. It wasn't too bad. And I went back road. So I didn't, you know, I didn't go quite so fast.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah. So there we go.
All righty.
There we go. So let's talk about our L question. I think it's a really great question. And it comes from Deanna. Deanna wanted to know, could you talk about why corners are important and what is expected of a corner at the various levels?
Sure. That's an excellent question. You know, as we all know, Aviva is the geometry Nazi. So I worry about corners, but I also worry about corners because corners help set you up for everything. You know, corners are about bend and straightness. And if you look at the tests at intro and training level, basically every single one of your transitions comes through, with the exception of your center line, comes through a corner. So if you're riding your corners correctly with, you know, inside flexion, your horse is already underneath himself and ready to do whatever kind of transition you want. So corners are important for that. Corners are also important because it's about accuracy. So what I see that's very interesting is I see one of two things at the lower levels. And by lower, I'm talking about intro and training right now. And that's the riders who either try to make a 90 degree turn, which an intro training level horse can't do. First, second, third, fourth level horse really has trouble with it also. I mean, if you think about it, a 90 degree turn is a quarter pirouette, right? So the first thing I see is either people who try to go too deeply into the corner and they unbalance their horses and it's a disaster, or they're the people who have no concept of the corner at all and are not on the short side, not on the long side, not in the corner, and particularly in the small ring. They've now taken a 20 by 40 meter arena and they've turned it into, you know, like a 15 by 30 meter arena, which is really small.
Oh, yeah.
So what I expect at intro is that you show me that there's some bend through the corner. I don't really expect it to be a 15 meter quarter circle. Although if you can do that, that's nice. But I want to see a little bit of flexion to the inside. I want to see you on the short side and then again on the long side, or, you know, oppositionally on the onside, on the long side, and then onto the short side, that, you know, you are clearly moving through the corner.
Okay.
I also want to basically see the same thing at training level, that you want to show that you are actually trying to go through the corner in some way. As you move up the levels, the level of bend through the corner increases. And it sort of increases with the level of difficulty of the circles and half circles in the tests. So, you know, there are some really tough things that we do at intro and training level, like that turn down center line is a 10 meter half circle. And that's tough. And that's why, and that's why at intro A, you do it from a walk, because the balance is so important. But as you start moving up the levels, we expect you to be able to make that 10 meter circle pretty easily. And of course, as you get up to third and fourth level, you start cantering down the center line and start making that turn. And that also informs the way that you use your corners. As you move up the levels, you start to have increased balance issues, and your transitions start to come on straight lines. So if you don't use your corner correctly and you need to make a transition, let's just say from trot to canter on the long side itself, like at K, you have to be balanced and prepared either to go into the corner or to come out of the corner. Otherwise, the chances are you're either not going to pick up the transition where you should, or you're going to be on the wrong lead. So
okay,
the corner is important to prepare you. The corner is important to prepare your horse. And the corner demonstrates that you are actually riding your horse and directing the travel as opposed to the arena doing that. So hopefully, hopefully that made sense. And
yeah,
you know, that's why corners are important, Deanna.
Well, I'm thinking about what you said about the intro level corners, you know, especially intro and training level. And it makes me think about some of the lower level eventing dressage tests,
yeah,
where they come in on center line and they don't even halt or salute. And they go from like X to H or X to M to start their test. So they don't have to make that 10 meter half circle. And I think some of them even do that at the end, that they come out of a corner letter,
right,
aim to X and then go straight. So they've taken into account the level of difficulty and they're minimizing it there.
Exactly. And also in those lower level event tests, one of the things that I find so interesting is that I think it is the novice test where they pick up the canter at K, not through the corner, at K.
And so a higher expectation.
And 90% of the riders, and this is because it's easier for the horses, you mm-hmm. know, pick up the canter before K because they use their corner to get that lead.
Mm.
So for those of you who event, I'm just telling you, we judges, we know what you're doing. You're cheating. You're cheating. You're making it easier.
That's awesome. You also judge the Western dressage. Is that correct?
Not as an official Western dressage judge, but yes.
Okay. Is yeah. there a different level of expectation there?
No.
Or does it?
No.
It kind of goes along with.
Exactly. And the same okay. with working equitation dressage. You know, dressage okay. is dressage is dressage.
Yes.
And, you know, the thing to do is to read your tests. I mean, so many people just look at the test sheet and they say, you know, A, down center line, X, you know, I'm going to halt and then I'm going to track right. And then, you know, at that letter, I'm going to make a circle and then I'm going to go across the diagonal. But they never really read what the expectations of each one of those movements is. And if you read them, it talks about balance through the transition. It talks about quality of the corner. It talks about straightness. You know, it talks about quality of the gates. So there is a reason that all of the tests are written the way they are. It is not arbitrary
right.
by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, if you really do pay attention to the tests, you will see that they're hard. They challenge the horses at those levels. You know, I remember many, many, many years ago, I was scribing for Ken Barbosa, and we were doing a second level test, and this horse that and rider who I knew came down our center line and got a beautiful score. And at the end of the test, Kem said, "This is an absolutely perfect second level test. This was not a second level test that the rider should be at third level. And this is not a first level rider who is struggling to get into second level. This was second level." And I remember thinking about, you know, what that meant and, you know, going back and reading, you know, what are the expectations of second level versus first level versus third level. So the tests are written to challenge you. You know, we've talked about this a lot. It's not just about being able to do the tricks. It's about being able to do the tricks correctly and in balance. And your corners inform so much of what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and as you move up the levels, the things that you have to do start closer and closer to your corner as well.
Yeah. And happen faster and faster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So hopefully that helps everybody.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Okay. We are now going to have a word from our sponsor. There's more talk than ever about the importance of probiotics in equine health. But not all probiotics are created equal. New Purina Systemic Supplement remains live and active after the pelleting process and throughout the digestive system, making it all the way to the hindgut. Systemic was designed to support normal recovery after exercise and occasional gastrointestinal stress. Whether you're using a probiotic now or not, it's time to use a live and active supplement from a name you trust. Visit mq.purinamills.com to try Purina Systemic Probiotic Supplement today.
Welcome back, everyone. We are very excited to introduce you to Suzanne DeStefano from Pennsylvania, who is a Feldenkrais practitioner. I have to be honest, I've heard about it, but I'm not really sure what it is. So could we start, Suzanne, with you just telling us a little bit about what is Feldenkrais?
Well, thank you for having me. And you know, do know this, that practitioners do hate that question.
I know they do. It's sort of like, what is Pilates?
Yeah.
All right. So I'll put it this way. You don't know what you don't know. And Feldenkrais helps uncover what you don't know. And you do that by paying attention and observing yourself.
Okay.
So you go towards the what's unfamiliar to you.
Give us an example.
Well, it's your movement patterns. So your habits are your movement patterns. So changing those movement patterns may be very odd. Just the simple way of doing it, if you interlace your fingers. So you'll notice that one thumb is up and all the other fingers follow down. And then you reverse it, put the other thumb on top. It feels really weird.
Yeah, I just did that.
Or like if you sit cross-legged, how we have a tendency to sit with one foot up and one foot down. And when you change, it feels like you're driving someone else's car kind of a thing.
Exactly.
Hmm.
So when we're talking about riding, you're talking about things like how we weight the stirrup, or where we sit in the saddle, or how we carry our shoulders.
Yes, and it's more detailed than that. It's your symmetry. I mean, none of us are symmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
So as a rider, have you ever had someone say or notice somebody else who kind of leans one direction or the other, and they feel they're absolutely straight?
Oh, yes, me.
Your movement, yeah. Somehow in your asymmetry. Or let's say you see someone at dusk walking towards you and you immediately know who it is. That person walks a certain way. So you recognize how they walk. That's their habitual pattern of movement.
Okay. So as a practitioner, do you work with people who are mounted or do you do it unmounted?
Yes, both.
Both. Okay. And how does that, so I know that some of the not correct movement patterns and asymmetries that I have are related to paralysis that I have in one leg. How is something like that addressed versus just we're all asymmetrical and we're all just struggling to be straight just like our horses are?
Well, as I say, there's always some sort of workaround. You may have to find different reference points.
Okay.
Since you don't have control of a certain area, you then have to sense yourself in different areas to acknowledge where you're at. I had someone I was working with who has neuropathy in her feet. She couldn't feel her feet very well, and her balance was off. So I showed her to sense where she was over her hip joints, and that changed a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Or I also increased her awareness of what she felt in her feet.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of ways you approach any challenges from multiple angles.
Okay.
And by doing that, you're looking at it from many different directions. So you can sense and feel what works for you, what you're noticing. Because we don't notice a whole lot most of the time.
That's very true.
So you expand what you notice.
Is this making people more aware of proprioception? Would that be one way to put it?
Pretty much, yeah. That's pretty fairly accurate.
Okay. Okay. And I guess, one of the things that I've had done as body work is Rolfing. I know that the roots of Rolfing come from Ida Rolf, who had a son that was very, very curled up in his body positioning and nothing was working. So she literally developed her life work by trying to fix her son. So how did Feldenkrais come into existence? What was the initiating reason for it?
With Moshe Feldenkrais, it was a pretty severe knee injury that he re-injured. His life story is really fascinating, but basically he was a scientist. He worked at the Curie lab in France during the war. He left France to go to England, where he worked for developing sonar for the war effort. So the story goes, he slipped on a submarine deck and re-injured his knee. And that's since he had a lot of time, he started to explore how he supported himself. And that was the birthplace of his thinking. Well, one of them, is if you look into who he was and everything kind of the universe came together.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So how long have you been doing Feldenkrais? How did you get involved with it?
How did I get involved with it? Well, every once in a while I would read a Feldenkrais quote and I'm like, that's kind of cool. And of course, Linda Tellington Jones, her method, the Tellington Jones T-touch came from Feldenkrais because she had been in a training with Moshe Feldenkrais.
I had no idea.
So that's where I probably heard Feldenkrais initially.
Okay.
And I just got to a point where I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. And I kept looking for things. And someone suggested after going through, I even went and applied to become a physical therapist. And when volunteering to do for physical therapy, little red flags kept popping up saying, Suzanne, that's not you. At a riding clinic, there was a physical therapist who was riding in the clinic. And afterwards, I started up a conversation with her and she said, you should look into Feldenkrais. So I did. And I literally, that was the catalyst that got me looking into what it was, although there wasn't much information out there. And I called to inquire about her professional training program. And that's when I just went in basically with only maybe 5 group classes, some of them recorded online. And the other thing I did was talk to several practitioners. And the interesting part of that, when I interviewed them, all of them, unprompted, said it changed their life. So I went, not knowing why I was there.
So the people that you talked to and the training that you did, was it riding specific or was it general Feldenkrais?
It was a professional Feldenkrais professional training.
Okay.
And I had no idea I never imagined touching people.
Mm-hmm.
Since one of the ways you work with one-on-one is to touch and move them. So that was not, I didn't know where it was leading me. Mm-hmm. I literally would go and the session, each segment was from 4 to 10, 12 days. And essentially you just roll on the floor for that during that time.
It sounds fun to me.
And it was. I was working really hard with horses and I had several jobs and I was exhausted and I would literally go there. This is pretty cool. I can sort of zone out a little bit and rest. It was great.
So you are a rider though, right?
Correct, yes.
And a dressage rider.
Yes, I had been teaching, training horses, trying to make a living at it. And we know how difficult that can be.
Oh, yeah.
And, several times burning out. And then I found myself in a job I hated.
What was it?
Yes, I was a call center supervisor.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's
it was a market
rough job.
It wasn't a sales. It was a market research.
Mm.
But it was not the friendliest environment.
I'm sure.
And I ended up leaving there, not sure what I was going to do. I did work for one of my old bosses freelance afterwards, but I needed something else. And that, I believe, was when I, at the same time, I was trying to explore what my next career was going to be because I didn't want to go back into the horse business. Financially, it's tough. What is the saying? You know, how do you make $1 million in the horse business? You start with $2 billion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And it's a hard way of, I'm not good at networking. I'm not good at marketing. I didn't have a lot of resources. So it's hard.
Yeah.
And I hear the stories from other professionals, how difficult it can be.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So after you went through the Feldenkrais training, did that training talk at all about using Feldenkrais with riding, or was that something that resonated for you that you walked forward with?
Not directly. I mean, Feldenkrais is about good function.
Mm-hmm.
Riding well is good function.
Yeah.
Sure.
So
where would a typical Feldenkrais practitioner be using this as a way to help people rehab from injuries or in other sports? Where would this be used?
There's so many uses for this. I mean, Feldenkrais technically can help everyone, but that's not a way to market anything. So you target to specific populations. Outside of horses, I've worked with children with special needs. I've worked with individuals with MS, with Parkinson's, with ALS. It's just to move better. Recovery from stroke.
That's all so interesting.
It just opens up and it does gain clarity. All this is to gain clarity of working with riders, which was my specialty from the get-go when I decided to give a go at being a Feldenkrais practitioner.
So how long did it take for you to become a practitioner of Feldenkrais?
It's a 4-year program. I was able to join a little late and make up. So I did it in about three and a half years, I think. And I also did another advanced certification, which was absolutely wonderful to clarify what I learned in my initial training. And it focused a lot on Feldenkrais principles and strategies. So it gained a lot of clarity. It improved how I teach, which again transfers to teaching riding and training horses. All right. So it's the embodiment, the process. It's process oriented as you change how you move. And since it's about dealing with forces, so it's the embodiment of what you want your horse to do. When you yourself experience the specificity needed for good function. So in other words, the ease of movement, even though you may be working hard, there's a sense of being in that zone, that ease.
Mm-hmm.
And the inner strength you uncover without having to lift heavy weights.
Mm-hmm.
Because how you organize a movement will provide you with more strength if you're well organized. So you then begin to pay attention with your horse, how straightness and balance are so specific and required in order to get a good performance from your horse. And the importance of lightness, that with Feldenkrais, you reduce the effort and you find what's easy. And then you realize that less really is more.
Yeah.
So from there, from the lightness, you can really listen. You think about in a quiet place, you can really listen to things. And that even goes to that ability to listen. Your seat needs to be quiet in order for you to listen to how the horse's back is organized. And it goes, there's that interface that happens, that your seat's quiet, and then any changes in that seat, the horse will feel. They're very sensitive, so they will feel that. And it's more beyond just shifts of weight. It's the change in how you carry yourself, increasing your muscular tonus and decreasing it will change whether you follow more or less, and the horse can sense those changes.
You know, one of the things listening to you, I know that Mary Wanless has Feldenkrais at least training in her background. And I am hearing a lot of the words that she uses in your explanation. And it's making it even clearer to me where some of this has come from. This, because it is both an undefined and very definite thing at the same time. If you don't know what, like you said, if you don't know what you don't know, you wouldn't know if you ran into it. But once you become aware of it, you take that knowledge with you pretty much everywhere.
Yes. And you, that ability to sense what you're doing is really important. We tend to shut down our sensory ability. And so Feldenkrais, by paying attention to how you're doing things, what you're doing, the sensations of it, finding, improving the quality of movement, finding greater ease leads you to efficiency in movement. And that transfers to how you view how you ride and interact with your horse.
It sounds really easy, but really hard. I'm thinking about, you know, my own riding challenges, and I know in my head things like I collapse to the right. And yet my proprioception is that I'm straight. And I've had people put me, you know, hands on, put me into straightness. And in the moment I feel it, but then they go away and I'm riding and the horse's movement and the dynamics of movement change me back so that I'm collapsing again. So how long does it take the average person to be able to take that new feeling and make it their own?
It depends on your nervous system, your ability to embrace this new sensation and take mm-hmm. it into your life. And a lot of people will facilitate a change and then walk out and go back to how they were going through their day-to-day life after that. So that you need to take what you learn in these sessions into your life, because this is applicable. And sometimes the nervous system does grab onto it and says, hey, this is pretty cool. Let's go, you know, we can continue on with this. So mm-hmm. sometimes it's really easy and the change happens without any, you know, work on your part. But sometimes you do need to be attentive. And it's the difference. The attentive is in a sense that you check in, as opposed to saying, well, Suzanne said I needed to do this, 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 and this, and you willfully try and correct it. I don't correct and fix you. I give you new sensations for you to take into your life and for you to do something with.
I like that. I like that a lot.
You know, we that's how typical we keep it wanting to achieve in our riding. And I know personally I had a certain level of accomplishments and then I hit a wall. So that's where, what do you do then?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And even though lessons were kind of still going the same old, same old, same old. And, you know, then my instructor got really mad at me because I wasn't digging deep enough. And I'm like, well, I've dug as deep as I can, because if you think I need to put in any more effort, I don't know what to do. So I was digging the wrong damn hole,
mm-hmm.
and I had to find something else. So I had to, as I say, in order to change your riding, to change your horse, you have to change yourself. Your horse isn't going to change until you interact in a different way.
True. True that.
Mm-hmm.
So in a situation, you work with riders, and do they also have a quote traditional instructor?
They can.
How does this blend back and forth?
That's individual as to what you take from your lessons and what your instructor is expecting from you. I mean, words are very imprecise.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the instructor may be saying something and your interpretation isn't the same as your instructor's intention.
Yeah.
And I do help the translation. So you can start to trust yourself, your own senses, and realize that your first interpretation, despite your best effort, may not be exactly what you need to do. And I'll say it, some instructors may ride really, really well, be extraordinary riders, but my theory is that they teach the way they've been taught and not how they ride. And there's a big disconnect.
Sure. Yeah.
We talk a lot about
the difference between being a rider, being a trainer, being an instructor, being a judge. They're all different skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
So if doing what you do does require a certain degree of hands-on to help people find where they need to be, is it possible to do Feldenkrais work virtually, or does it have to be live?
Well, first, you don't have to do hands-on. I do verbally directed lessons.
Okay. And
for example, I was a professional. I've done many years of Feldenkrais at that point, but I did do an five or six day advanced training where I did not ride one horse. I came back from that 6 day training. It was verbally directed. I was one time a demo person, but that I don't believe had any real impact. But I came back, sat on a client's horse, and was a completely changed rider. I was sitting differently. I was functioning differently. It was mind-blowing to me, and even my client noticed it.
Wow.
It was about, the title of the workshop was self-organization again and again and again and again. So you were working. The first day, he was like talking about how he wanted to us as practitioners use ourselves when we were hands-on working with someone. And afterwards, and it never dawned on me, I said, this is exactly what I'm trying to develop as a rider.
So it
was a fascinating process because he reinforced everything I was going towards as far as the series of lessons, Feldenkrais lessons he chose to use.
Do you feel that there are differences in the way that you would work with riders depending on what their disciplines are? Or is the sense of straightness and ability to use your body the same regardless?
Good function is good function.
Okay.
It respects physics.
Okay.
You know, so in teaching riders, it's not the discipline as much as it's the function. But what does happen in different disciplines, there ends up being a lot of exaggerated trends. And where that comes from, whether it's from competition, a certain rider starts winning, they have a kind of an aberrant style, and then everyone tries to copy it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only thing, but it's still good function. And you can still have an aberrant style in some ways and still function the rest of you pretty well. So,
okay.
Yeah, that brings up a whole new conversation on, you know, how people compete at high levels that really don't have ideal positions and still have the capability. I believe a lot of them still have certain things that are really core to them that still is good function.
Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Here's a question for you. Could you do a little example? Could you Feldenkrais us a little bit?
Sure. Yes.
Okay.
And if you just roll your pelvis, so you sit on your back pockets and then come forward. So you're basically coming from rounding your back, so you slump, to coming forward and arching your back.
Okay.
Okay.
So you're doing that from your pelvis. A lot of people will do it from their shoulders and they bow and unbow in front. But if you were to, instead of driving it with your pelvis, take the tops of your femurs, can you feel that? And then, so you're drawing your knees into you. And can you roll your pelvis from there by activating that those deep, deep muscles around the top of your...
Wow, that's hard.
Mm. It makes it more external. It's more the outside of my pelvis than more underneath my seat bones where I was thinking before.
Think of it, you still have the intention of rolling your pelvis back, but you add in the sensation of taking the tops of your femurs into your pelvis, the joint, the mm-hmm. acetabulum. Does that change it?
Yes.
Okay.
Also, the way I'm sitting in the chair.
Right.
You need I had to scoot up more. Yeah.
Yeah. Scoot to the front of the, I forgot that part.
Yeah.
You need to scoot to the front of the chair.
Yeah. That was really hard leaning back there.
If you're already back, that's kind of hard.
Yeah.
Okay. So from there, just notice as you do that, are you engaging one of your hip joints more than the other? Does one start before the other?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Try the one you notice starts and feel how clear that is on that side. And then try the other one. And you'll notice you may not have the same clarity on that side. And what is the difference between the two?
And it also doesn't roll as much.
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting.
So that's a very simple. It's good for riders, so it helps you find where your hip joints are.
Yeah.
You can almost feel the top of your femur a little more clearly than your hip joint. If I said hip joint, it's hard. A lot of people think it's the top of the pelvis.
Mm-hmm.
Or the outside of the greater trochanter. But from feeling the top of your femur really starts to, you just draw it into the pelvis. And it's like, oh, it's way down deep in there.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And by noticing side to side, which side's clearer, you then start to get familiar with some asymmetries.
And the goal would be to try to iron out those asymmetries, or is it merely to be aware that they exist?
It's both. I mean, it does. Okay. I mean, a lot of times there's different strategies to equalize yourself. One is to feel, what are you doing on the side that's clearer? It's not always strength. It's the neural connections that you can't tell your brain's not telling your body to do this. You're not going to find it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in strength training that happens spontaneously, but the intention here is you're going straight to the core of the challenge.
That's super cool.
Yeah. I'm going to ask a very loaded question that you may not want to answer. How does this differ from something like Pilates? Is it the way that you're approaching things? Because it seems to me that Pilates is also about being aware of how you move your body and teaching your body new movement patterns.
Well, I'm not super familiar with Pilates.
Okay.
But if you think of all these other, even like yoga or Tai Chi, Pilates, there's a goal-oriented aspect and process-oriented.
Okay.
This is my take on it. Pilates is far more goal-oriented. There is some process. Yoga is a combination. Tai Chi is probably a little more process-oriented.
Okay.
So people need to move. No matter what you choose, it's wonderful. Because by doing Pilates or yoga, you're doing different things. I mean, the nervous system recognizes, you get the attention of the nervous system through novelty. And that's where Feldenkrais really works. It does these movements that you wouldn't normally be doing in a day-to-day thing. You don't think of pulling the top of your femur into your hip joint to change
right.
how you move, do you?
Mm-hmm. No.
So by having this different way of looking about how you create and initiate a movement. I showed you can round from your pelvis. You can drive it from your pelvis. You can drive it from your hip, from your femurs. You can drive it from your rib cage. There's many different ways of rounding and arching your back. And all of that is it's transmission of forces and managing forces in different ways.
It's fascinating.
It's very cool. Yes.
It's even cooler when you start to, you think of these different reference points that you're utilizing to go from intention to action. You start to think of the same thing in your riding. It's like, okay, where's the force coming from the horse? What are you sensing from behind? What are you sensing from in front? Where is the lift in the back, if there is one, coming from? Is it only coming from behind? That means probably they're staying low in their trunk. So you need to feel the lift in front as equally as the sitting behind. And you can start to really start to differentiate how the force goes, forces are created and transmitted through the horse.
So for riders, do you recommend working with a Feldenkrais practitioner who is a rider and who works primarily with riders? Or could a general practitioner also be of benefit?
A general practitioner can be of benefit. Some practitioners are more skilled than others with Feldenkrais in transmitting the information.
Okay.
I believe it's helpful to have a practitioner that also understands riding, because then they know the nuances of what you're going to, but it's not always necessary. A good practitioner should be able to get you to good function where you can find what's better. I mean, the training I went to, that he wasn't a rider. I ended up being a totally different, everything unified.
Mm-hmm.
And I was functioning as a really, really well, a unit. All of a sudden it changed. Everything connected, even though all my joints were moving independent of each other if they needed to be. So I was able to differentiate myself, but also bring it all together after that 6-day workshop and find a totally different rider at the other side.
So if I was looking for a practitioner, how would I start? What would I do? I mean, I know you're in Pennsylvania, so you're relatively close to me, but let's say we have somebody in Minnesota who's listening to us now who says, I want to try this. Where is there a listing of some kind?
There is a Find a Practitioner tab on the Feldenkrais.com website.
Okay.
To find a local practitioner. You can do it by location. You can do it, I believe, by keywords.
Okay.
Or the person's name.
And if people are particularly struck by you, do you offer virtual work?
Yes, I do. I currently have 2 Zoom group classes during the week, one on Mondays at 9 a.m. and then Thursdays at 7:30 p.m. And COVID took me online, and it's amazing how well it translates really well online. And I ended up during COVID doing privates, which was like, oh, I can't do privates. This is crazy. But I had someone it was a client's son that was having some difficulty with running. He'd get pain in his hip. He said it was actually in his side. And I don't remember the particulars, but I was able to like solve his problem. It was like really cool. And then I started working with several others, and I have clients in the U.S., not in my local area, that I started just online with, and some of them are still in my class, but I started privately with them, yeah.
You've got a couple different offerings as well. I mean, not only are you on Facebook, but you've got some YouTube videos and shorts. You do have your podcast, and you have a website as well.
Okay. I do have a very small YouTube channel and with only a handful of videos, but hopefully someday I'll have a few more. I do have a podcast, which is Course Skills for Dressage Riders. That's on all the major players. And I'm also on Facebook and Instagram.
Oh, I forgot about Instagram. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Not the best at being active on any of those, but
they're so hard to manage. It's so hard to manage.
Yeah.
Well, when you get busy outside, then it becomes a challenge.
Yes. And I think most horse people would prefer to be even cleaning the barn to sitting down in front of the computer and doing some, you know, some production work. Right. We know we should be, but whether we're actually doing it or not is a whole nother.
Oh, but cleaning the barn is so zen.
It is. If we could figure out a way to hang like a microphone on us while we were cleaning the barn, can you imagine? We might be able to solve world peace. That would be pretty amazing.
If I do listen to podcasts sometimes during the barn.
Well, Suzanne, this was wonderful.
Thank you. Yes, it's very deep and thoughtful. Like I can see that this is not something one does frivolously, but I can see that it also has very long running repercussions.
Yes, it did change my life. It changed my riding. I think differently. My eye is my superpower because I can see these subtle inside moves that just totally flew past me in the past. And my experience with my horses and my clients' horses are so different.
That's wonderful.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us about this. I think this is one of those that I need to sit and just sort of think about a little bit more. And I'm going to certainly take a look at your website and your YouTube channel. And I would like to say a quick thank you to Elena, who was the one who recommended that we talk to you, because this is great information. So thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It has been an absolute pleasure.
Yes, we've enjoyed it tremendously. Thank you.
You're very welcome.